Much of the world this weekend are marking the 30th anniversary of the opening of the Berlin Wall, a watershed moment that led to the unraveling of the former Soviet Union's hold on Eastern Europe. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has our report.
Leaders from Germany and other European nations are attending ceremonies in Berlin, recalling the peaceful protests that piled pressure on East Germany's government to allow its citizens free passage to the West on November 9, 1989. The main commemoration is being held at Bernauerstrasse, where one of the last parts of the Berlin Wall that divided the city for 28 years still stands. Light installations, concerts and public debates are also being held throughout the city and other parts of Germany to mark the anniversary. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The U.S. House of Representatives moves its impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump into the open next week before a national TV audience. The background, transcripts of private testimony from mainly current administration witnesses who concluded what Mr. Trump wanted in his dealings with Ukraine was indeed a quid pro quo. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has a report.
In the latest impeachment inquiry transcripts, top national security officials describe diplomats as tense and frustrated about the backdoor effort in Ukraine run by Rudy Giuliani and supported by the president. AP's Eric Tucker with details.
There is a sense and a description from these two witnesses about this desire to move Ukraine policy out of the normal foreign policy channels and have that responsibility delegated to Rudy Giuliani.
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vidman, a top national security officer, also insisted there was no ambiguity. Trump was proposing a trade to Ukraine's president, an Oval Office visit for a public investigation of former Vice President Joe Biden and his son. Tim McGuire, Washington.
To stay up to date on all the day's news, we invite you online to voanews.com. There is also a convenient, easy-to-use mobile app. From Washington, this is VOA News. India's Supreme Court today decided to hand over a disputed plot of land to Hindus, paving the way for the construction of a temple in the town of Ayodhya in northern India, where a Hindu mob tore down a 16th century mosque more than 25 years ago, when 2,000 people died in riots. Ruling unanimously on one of the country's oldest and most contentious religious disputes, a five-judge panel ordered that Muslims should be given an alternate piece of land for a mosque. President Trump next week welcomes Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to the White House. The visit comes just weeks after Turkey launched an assault on Kurdish fighters in Syria, longtime allies of the United States against Islamic State terrorists. U.S. lawmakers from both parties have slammed the president for what they consider his green light for Ankara's Syria incursion, his plan to withdraw U.S. troops from the Kurdish border area. The UN Children's Fund warns that essential humanitarian programs for hundreds of thousands of children in Syria will have to be cut because it's run out of cash. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
With just 8 weeks left until the end of the year, the UN Children's Fund reports only 53% has been met of its $295 million appeal for 2019. Unless this major funding shortfall is urgently closed, it reports many children will be denied the life-saving assistance they need. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says these force cuts come at a particularly difficult time of the year.
With temperatures dropping quickly, UNICEF's aim is to provide 578,000 children 0 to 14 years old in camps, shelters, host communities, and areas of acute need with crucial winter clothing. At this point, we have funds for 356,000 children. Without additional funding, 220,000 children will go without.
Lisa Schlein filed that report for VOA from Geneva. Lebanon says its banks will be closed until Tuesday amid the paralysis of political and economic turmoil. Banks reopened last week after being shuttered for 2 weeks because of anti-government protests aimed at getting the government to resign. On Friday, large numbers of university and high school students again joined the protests after leaving their classrooms. Police in several cities in Bolivia joined anti-government protests early this weekend. The demonstrations began last month, sparked by the disputed re-election of President Evo Morales to a fourth term in office. Agence France-Presse reported that some police in La Paz returned to their station house to avoid confronting protesters. In the central city of Cochabamba, officers demanded the resignation of their commander, considered a Morales supporter. The president has called the protests an attempted coup. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
All the resources we needed for the implementation of the agreement. So if sanctions were to be used, then sanctions should be used on the incumbency. Dr. Adek Machar has already paid a price for his intent to bring the limitations to the country.
A senior member of the SPLM-IO calls on the U.S. to pressure South Sudanese President Salva Kiir to keep his promises regarding the formation of a transitional government.
You know, it's only the candidates from Chama Chama Pinduzi, CCM, that were endorsed. The rest were cancelled out. How can you participate in an election where you are sure that 98 to 99% of all the available seats have been taken and opposed by one political party, which is in government?
The Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, says it will boycott the upcoming local government elections.
Every time we go to demonstration, there are more and more and more people. So we will continue. We have to defend our right. And the only thing we have in our Guinean constitution is say, if government don't hear what you say, you can demonstrate. So this is why we do that.
And a Guinean opposition leader says demonstrations will continue until President Alpha Conde commits to stepping down after his term expires next year. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A leading member of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLM-IO, says Dr. Riek Machar is not to blame for the repeated delays in the formation of the transitional government in South Sudan. Manasseh Zindo is calling on the U.S. to pressure President Salva Kiir's government to keep its promises. His remarks came after Thibault Nagy, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, expressed disappointment that both President Kiir and Machar agreed to postpone the pre-interim period for 100 more days. For reaction to the U.S. official statement, I reached Manasseh Zindo, the SPLM-IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sports in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
When we've received that information, the bit of reservation, because it is not based on the realities on the ground, is that the agreement was signed last year in September. Up to now, the ceasefire has gone. Relative peace has returned to some parts of the country. And the SPLM-IO felt that the best thing to do is to make sure that we implement the outstanding issues. And the only way we could do it was to call for an extension. This is the information which the American Embassy in Cuba is fully aware of. So unless the envoy is not well informed by the embassy in Cuba.
But don't you think that other South Sudanese are also disappointed, because it appears that the differences between your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, and President Salva Kiir are not being resolved? The conflict is still going on despite the relative peace that you spoke about. Why can't this be resolved once and for all so you have a unity transitional government as originally rescheduled for November 12?
Many South Sudanese who are able to speak to us whenever we interact with them support the position of the SPLM-IO, because what the SPLM-IO is pushing for is what would bring lasting peace to the country. Now, Dr. Riek Machar has no difference with President Salva. President Salva and his team have a phobia of Dr. Riek Machar, that they fear him so much that they do not want to implement the agreement simply because of the fear for him. Dr. Riek Machar has done everything possible. He has complied with all the chapters of the agreement, including going to Cuba several times, even when his security was not guaranteed. So what needs to be done is really for the government. I have just seen a statement now that President Salva is saying that he is going to release the funds which is needed for the implementation of the security arrangement. And I can assure you that if those funds are released on November 12th, then we will be able to implement all the outstanding issues within the 100 days.
Some South Sudanese are also supporting what the U.S. Undersecretary for African Affairs is talking about, questioning whether President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar are the main people who can restore peace to South Sudan. After all these years and tension and mistrust among them, why shouldn't that be questioned?
The South Sudanese who do not understand the dynamics on the ground. These two principles have influence over the movement and the government that they lead. It is important that they are supported so that they implement the agreement, and from there the country can move forward. They will not be in leadership forever, but as of now we need them to lead the country into a peaceful settlement.
Some are also welcoming that the U.S. government should expedite action by putting sanctions on both your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, and President Salva Kiir in order to put pressure on you to expedite action to restore peace.
The pressure should be exercised on the incumbency because the incumbency has a lot to do. The incumbency needs to show political will. The incumbent needs to release all the resources which is needed for the implementation of the agreement. So if sanctions were to be used, then sanctions should be used on the incumbent. Dr. Riek Machar has already paid a price for his stance to bring the leadership to the country.
Manasseh Zindo is the SPLM-IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sport. He spoke with me from Nairobi. The chairperson for the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema, says central committee members and parliamentarians of the party have unanimously agreed to boycott the upcoming local government elections scheduled for November 24. Freeman Mbowe says it is unacceptable for the government to act as an umpire and a player in the elections. For more reaction regarding the upcoming local government elections, I read Chadema chairperson Freeman Mbowe in the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Together, we decided to pull out of the ongoing local elections process because of the nature of fraud that is involved in this whole process. We, as a party, managed to mobilize about 80% of our members to contest for all the seats available. But during the process of the returning officers, which belongs to the government, and of course they belong to Chama Cha Mapinduzi, CCM, decided that our members don't qualify for various reasons. And consequently, from 85% of all the contestants in the country, they left us with less than 5% of the contestants in the whole country. Now, under such case, that would mean a minimum of 95% of all the seats are won by CCM even before the election day. We could not accept this kind of fraud, and we decided to pull out of the elections process.
So, Mr. Mbowe, some Tanzanians are saying, why don't you engage to address your concerns instead of pulling out of it, claiming there is fraud before the election even begins on November 24?
So you can see the management of this election is the government itself. It's not the Independent Electoral Commission. And these government officials are all from the Chama Cha Mapinduzi. So they are the players, at the same time, they are the referees, okay? And we've been complaining about this, that we need an independent body to oversee and supervise the elections, but the government will not give in. That is one. But point number two, we raise different concerns over a long period of time that we cannot allow the whole country, all the local government settings, to be governed by officials who have no moral authority simply because they were not elected by the people. This would mean that almost 100% of the local government leaders would be assuming their position in office without going through the election process. And we find this being a sad. How can the election managers eliminate or cancel out all the members from the opposition so that the CCM people and CCM candidates can win the elections without contesting. That is suicide to democracy, and I don't think there was any room to talk to anybody. But nevertheless, we spoke to the ministers responsible, we raised our concern, we raised our complaints. But the regulations and rules, the way they are spewed up, you have no room and enough time to even go to court to ask for some kind of redress to the problem. So we thought the best solution out is just to pull out and start the process where we can complain.
So, Mr. Mbowe, talking about democracy that you mentioned in your submission, some people are saying pulling out and refusing to participate in the November 24 local government elections means your party is depriving Tanzanians the opportunity to make a choice between your party and other political parties, including the CCM, and that this will weaken Tanzania's democracy. How do you respond to those who are saying this?
The election supervisor, that is the government of President Magufuli, decided out of the 570 contestants in different streets in the city of Dar es Salaam alone, the opposition was left with only 24 streets and 546 or something like that were all taken by CCM unopposed. And you want us to endorse this kind of mockery to democracy, James? No, we could not do this. And out of these rural settings, all the opposition parties combined were left with less than 200 villages, but more than 12,000 villages were, you know, it's only the candidates from Chama Cha Mapinduzi, CCM, that were endorsed. The rest were cancelled out. How can you participate in an election where you are sure that 98 to 99% of all the available seats have been taken unopposed by one political party which is in government?
Freeman Mbowe is the chairperson for the Tanzanian main opposition party, CHADEMA. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. Victoire Ingabire, a Rwandan opposition leader, says she is forming a new political party to be called Dalfa Umurinzi. This after stepping down as the leader of the FDU Inkingi party. Ingabire says the new party, which has yet to be officially registered by the authorities, will seek for the development and liberty for all Rwandans. But skeptics say it is unlikely to receive a warm welcome by the authorities due to the narrowed political space in Rwanda. To learn more about the party, I reach opposition leader Victoire Ingabire in the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
In 2010, we decided to come president in Rwanda to do all political activity. But as you know, I was arrested. I spent 8 years in jail. And when I was released, until today, I don't have any authorization to leave the country. And other members of the committee are outside, because we can't work together, except if we, for example, organize a meeting on internet. And I think that it is not good for all the political parties to work on the internet. They decided to step down and to create new political party inside Rwanda with Rwandans who are inside. We can meet, we can organize, we can decide together, but there are the members of the FDU outside, we can't. This is why we decided members of the inside Rwanda to create our own political party.
Are you therefore saying that because of the challenges you are having, you want only members of the party to be resident in Rwanda instead of having members outside the country where you can also communicate with them via the internet?
Yes, we can communicate on the internet, but we can't meet. But if we can't meet, we can, for example, discuss about strategies or something like that. And they cannot discuss the strategy of the party on the internet. This is why we think that good to stay together. It is better that the members inside Rwanda created their own party.
So who is going to lead the FDU Ikingi party now that you have stepped down? Whom did you hand over to?
I hand over to the committee where outside the country, they will self-decide who will be the leader. I don't know who they will appoint it, because I am no longer a member of FDE. I can't say anything about it.
So talk to me about your new party. When do you officially launch it? And have you contacted the authorities to register it as an opposition political party in Rwanda?
We will be charged to contact the government to ask the registration of all political parties. But we know that it's not going to be easy because, as you know, in Rwanda we have the problem of political space. This is a long way we have to go, but we are still convinced that we can't have sustainable development without democracy.
Do you have members who are committed to you to join your party, or are you getting members from your old political party switching to the yet-to-be-formed Dafa Umurinzi party?
Yes, the members who are with me in Rwanda, we created it. But outside, I don't know, because it is today that we published our new political party. In a few days, maybe we will see if we are some members we can work together with us.
So what do you see as the prospect of your party? What are your expectations for the new party that you plan to officially register soon?
You know, the next week we really approach the local authority, asking the authorization to organize our first meeting, and we hope that they will give us this authorization. If we receive the authorization to organize our first meeting, then we will meet, and then we will ask the registration for political parties. That not depends to us, but the will of the local authority and the will of the government.
Victoire Ingabire is the leader of the newly formed opposition party, Dafa Umurinzi. She spoke with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. A prominent Guinean opposition leader says demonstrations against plans by President Alpha Condé to seek additional terms will continue. Sidya Touré, leader of the opposition Union of Republican Forces Party, says it is unacceptable for the president to want to seek additional terms when his second five-year term ends next year. This after the UN Secretary General Special Representative for West Africa and the Sahel called for dialogue to come up with measures to organize elections, an effort to resolve the political crisis. Opposition leader Sidya Touré tells me civil society and opposition groups are open to the dialogue but are disinterested in talks that could lead to additional terms for the president.
Depending on Alpha Condé, you know, we have a constitution and things is absolutely clear. In that constitution, nobody can have more than two terms. If he declares that, you know, he is going to respect the constitution, there will be no demonstration. So, but if not, continue the demonstration. And every time the more we ask for demonstration, more people will have in the street. So we'll continue anyway.
Mohamed Ibn Chambers, the UN's General Secretary Special Representative for West Africa and the Sahel, has called for a national dialogue in Guinea to end the political crisis in your country. What is your reaction to his call?
I know Ibn Chambers, and Ibn Chambers, he knows us here. Yeah. He knows everybody because he was in charge for Guinea when he was in ECOWAS. Absolutely, I agree with him. The only thing we cannot negotiate is to have a discussion about the fact that we can modify the constitution to give a possibility to Alpha to stay more than two terms. That is not negotiable, you know. This is about the constitution. If not, all possibility is still open.
But there are concerns that there wouldn't be any solutions without any credible dialogue. What do you seek in a credible dialogue apart from removing the extension of President Condé's term as a precondition to hold the dialogue?
I say dialogue about the election, dialogue about the electoral list. We have a lot of problem in Guinea here. This guy used to cheat the election any time. So we can have a dialogue, no dialogue about the modification of the constitution. That's very clear for us.
Last time when you met ambassadors and regional leaders in ECOWAS, have you heard any response from them? And what is the next step forward for the opposition and civil society organization organizing this series of protests against what you described as plans by Professor Conde, the president, to seek additional terms in office.
They have a communique and they say clearly they are not supporting any modification that can bring a president to have more than two terms if it is in his constitution. This is very clear in the ECOWAS. All the countries around us are discussing the same thing and they all agree that that cannot be done.
But President Conde has said repeatedly that the people of Guinea will decide whether he stays or goes and that his term expires next year. So why are you still organizing these series of demonstrations that some people are saying is creating tension and instability and plunge the country in a political crisis?
I think the most simple thing is to say, I'm going to respect the constitution. Why we don't discuss the term of this kind of referendum or so? Because they will cheat everything. This guy here, I think, since 2010, he cheat every election. So we say there will be no election but modification of the constitution. In over time, we can discuss the condition to go to parliamentary election or so. But we know that what is the condition to hold election in Guinea. So if you have this kind of thing, we can have 90% who will declare is not known. They win.
What is next after holding what many Guineans are saying the most well-attended demonstration against the third term of Professor Conde? What is next for the opposition and civil society groups organizing these series of demonstrations in Conakry and beyond?
We want to have people in the street to ask to Alpha to change his mind about this question. If not, we will continue demonstration. And every time we go to demonstration, there are more and more and more people. So we will continue. We have to defend our right. And the only thing we have in our Guinean constitution is say, if government don't hear what you're saying, you can demonstrate. So this is why we're doing that.
But there have been instances where news on social media and other news organizations in Guinea showing supporters of President Conde going in the street and supporting and backing him. How do you react to that?
If you pay some people to go on the street and you say to all the people, the government use you, if you don't come to the demonstration of a president, you will lose your job. You go to market and you say to ladies, if you don't come to the demonstration, you know, you will have no place to stay in market anymore. They do all the things, but it's just less than 10% of what we did. So, you know, this is not very important for us. Anyway, we have they have to show it again, and we'll see, because they spend more than $1 million to do so. I think we will not have money to do it again.
Sidi Ature is the leader of the Guinean Opposition Union of Republican Forces Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Conakry.
Weekend is here, and so is another new episode of Music Time in Africa. Hello, everybody. I'm Heather Maxwell. Get your Pan-African groove on with current and classic hits, upbeat neo-traditional tunes, and great songs by undiscovered artists, too. Today's feature is none other than the golden voice of Africa, Salif Keita. He joined me in the studio earlier this week in Washington. How are you?
I'm okay. Ça va très bien.
Song of the Week, Diade by Gato Preto, will definitely charge up your batteries. And wait till you hear our vintage tune from MTIA Archive. It takes you back to 1968, Uganda. So join me, Music Time in Africa, this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15:05 and 20:05 Universal Time.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a slum in Uganda and a poor neighborhood in the United States have something in common, chess. We'll explore how one man uses chess to create social change on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Secretary General of the Zimbabwean Hospital Doctors Association says it is unacceptable for the authorities to consider sacking additional doctors who recently went on strike. Tawanda Zvaka says the government appears to be acting in bad faith, despite ongoing talks with the group to resolve their concerns. Tawanda Zvaka tells me the Zimbabwean Hospital Doctors Association is demanding the immediate reinstatement of the sacked doctors and for the government to desist from carrying out plans to sack additional doctors.
Day 68 since doctors declared incapacitation nationwide. And as you are aware, that the health service board is in the process of firing all striking doctors, and it's in the process of conducting disciplinary hearings. So we expect the doctors to be fired to rise to 516. And as an association, we condemn these actions by the health service board. And if we are to allow for any meaningful negotiations to happen going forward, we call for the immediate reinstation of these fired doctors to pave way for dialogue. In as much as they are arguing that it's a procedural thing, we as an association, we condemn it in the strongest possible terms, and we will not allow it in any way.
After the organization wrote to the authorities, have you had any feedback? And when do you anticipate for dialogue to begin to resolve this issue?
Yes, we have met with the minister and we have reiterated our position as an association that we demand a reinstation of these fire doctors, and also demand that these disciplinary hearings be stopped with immediate effect. And the minister assured that these were procedural things that were supposed to happen since no one is above law. But however, he said that this should not affect negotiations that has already started. I assign that the board is already negotiating in bad faith, and we question its sincerity in resolving this ongoing impasse. And we still hope that it will come back to its senses and realize that we are in an abnormal situation that does not need them to continue acting in the way that they are acting.
Supporters of the government are saying that the doctors are aware that the prevailing economic conditions are not conducive enough to meet your demands, and that you negotiated in bad faith by even going on demonstration and crippling the health sector in Zimbabwe. So you should bear the blame and not the government. What is your response to that?
Well, this is all propaganda coming from the government. We know that our government has got the capacity to pay us what we are worth it, because we see from the way that they are spending. It's a matter of negligence on the healthcare system. And it's a matter of not prioritizing the healthcare system. And to say that our demonstrations and declaration of incapacitation are negotiating in bad faith, it's actually utter nonsense, and we will not take cognizance of that. In that, warnings were given to the government 3 weeks prior to our members engaging in these so-called industrial actions. And the government decided to pay a deaf ear. And before even these three-week notices, we have been trying to engage the government in all possible ways. And what's worrying is that it is us on the part of the association. We have been calling for the meeting, and government hasn't been forthcoming to address to the genuine pleas that have been raised by the doctors.
Apart from the negotiations, what actions can you also take to prevent this? Because in your NDI submission, you said that the union will prevent this from happening, that all these doctors will be sacked.
Well, as a union, we can't really do much because the ball right now is not in our court. But one position that we have is to make sure that there won't be any negotiations or meaningful negotiations going forward before the reinstation of these fired doctors.
Tawanda Zvaka is the Secretary General of the Zimbabwean Hospital Doctors Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. We'll be right back. The U.S. government has announced the extension of temporary protected status, or TPS, designation to a number of countries. The TPS is a program usually reserved to help foreign nationals from countries entrapped in wars or facing natural disasters. The countries include Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, and Haiti. Joanna LeBlanc, a foreign affairs and legal analyst, joins me live to discuss the extension of the TPS as well as new immigration measures currently under consideration in Congress. Hello, Joanna. How are you?
Hello. Good morning and bonjour to our French listeners.
Well, so let me ask you, what are your thoughts about the extension of the TPS?
So let's go back a little bit to give this conversation context. The Trump administration had decided to rescind the executive order to provide for TPS recipients.
Right.
And as we know, the way the law is written, the way that our Constitution is written, an executive order is just what it is. It has no teeth. So whenever a president comes to office and the executive order is not in alignment with his or her, well, with his agenda in our case, by a stroke of a pen, it could be rescinded.
Right.
And presidents rescind hundreds of executive orders. That's just what it is. But what happened is some of the recipients decided to challenge this. This was the first time this had ever been challenged, and this was done through the ACLU Foundation,
right,
in California. And the argument was that, you know, the reason why TPS was terminated is because of biases that exist, and it's because of racism, because, as we know, unfortunately, the president of the United States had made some comments regarding countries like Haiti, Nicaragua, countries in Africa. So the position of the petitioners is that the reason why it was rescinded is because of racist motives. So as a result of the petition, and as a result of the lawsuit, the folks who were supposed to have been deported were no longer in deportation proceedings.
Right.
The administration had to allow them to stay. Now, the court had decided to rule in favor of the petitioners. So the Trump administration actually appealed the decision, which is why it has been extended. So, and the case is Ramos versus Nielsen. So I want people to understand that the reason why this program was extended is not because the Trump administration woke up and said, you know what, these people, they've been productive members of society. They have contributed to the economy of this nation. They have utilized their ingenuity and their talents to make America a much greater nation. That's not why. It is because of pending litigation in court right now. So the administration had no choice but to extend TPS for Haiti, Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Sudan until January 2021. However, what is happening in Congress right now is...
No, before you go to Congress, mm-hmm, let's look at the significance of the TPS, mm-hmm, as it is, mm-hmm, in law.
The significance of TPS, and as you said earlier, mm-hmm, the premise behind the program is to provide relief to folks from countries that are torn when it comes to natural disasters, mm-hmm, civil wars, political instability, and other issues that prohibits the country from moving forward. So that's why those people are here, because they're not able to pursue life, liberty, and happiness in their countries.
But you know, some supporters mm-hmm, of the government are saying that a lot of people are taking advantage of existing immigration law, so there has to be some tightening in order to prevent people from abusing it.
Mm.
And that is why they are in support of what the government is currently doing. What is your take?
Well, as an immigrant myself, I'm very pro-immigrant. I'm from the Republic of Haiti, came here at the age of eight. My position is that, you know, there's this argument that immigrants are getting free things, right? They're using our system the system to get ahead, and they're taking advantage of the system, which is quite the contrary. Because I can tell you, based on my own personal experience, when my family and I, when we moved to America, we know that we could have had, you know, we weren't people of means, right? And there were social programs to assist, whether it's assistance to get housing, assistance for employment, different assistance for food, different types of assistance. And what I can tell you is the immigrant community is often very uncomfortable with the notion of utilizing social programs to get ahead, right? Plus, and another way we have to look at it is a lot of these people in their respective countries, those social programs don't even exist. So for them, it's as if, you know, it doesn't exist to them either in the United States. So I think the idea that immigrants are taking advantage of our system is false. It's a false narrative. People are here because they have no choice. I can assure you that there are people who in their respective countries are lawyers, doctors, engineers, but they come to America, start from nothing. Why would someone do that? Why would you leave your home where you have status in society to come to a country where you have to start from nothing?
Well, the
something has to be incredibly wrong.
Right. The contrary argument is that they just want to come to America, the land of opportunity, the land of the free. But talk to me about what is currently under consideration in Congress.
Sure. So earlier this year, Congress passed, well, the House of Representatives passed the Dream and Promise Act of 2019, which under that particular piece of legislation, TPS recipients as well as DACA recipients would have a pathway to permanent residency and ultimately citizenship if you qualify. Right. And there are certain standards that you have to meet. And it was perhaps one of the most progressive piece of legislation to have been passed under this current administration. Right now, the bill is in the Senate. And as you know, in the United States, in order for a bill to become a law, it has to be passed in both the House and the Senate.
Right.
And ultimately, the president has to sign it. The unfortunate reality is that immigration is not a priority for the Senate under the leadership of Mitch McConnell. So that bill has not even been introduced. But what happened is the Senate introduced a bill called the Secure Act. And that bill, if it were to pass, it would provide similar protection as it would in the House.
Right.
But my issue with the Secure Act is Secure Act would focus only on TPS immigrants, on TPS recipients, rather, not the DACA recipients. And we know there is overwhelming evidence that shows that there is a lot of support for DACA recipients. So if you have a bill that protects both DACA recipients and TPS recipients, it is more likely to pass than a bill that protects only TPS recipients by itself. So that's one of my issues with that approach. But what I want to urge the public to do, and especially folks from Sudan, because I know it's about 1,000 Sudanese who are TPS recipients. Yes, there is a temporary extension until 2021, but keep the advocacy going. You cannot stop. What needs to happen is a piece of legislation has to be passed, because TPS is just what it is. It's a temporary protective status. So at any time, it could be rescinded. And so what we have to focus on is getting Congress to pass either the Dream and Promise Act of 2019 or the Secure Act that would provide pathway to permanent residency and ultimately citizenship to over 300,000 TPS recipients in America.
Well, Joanna, we have to continue this at another time. Joanna LeBlanc is a foreign affairs and legal analyst. She joined us live from the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C.
Well,
right now. It's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Akon with Welcome to Africa. Jovia follows next with Gugu, Radio, and Weasel. We'll come your way with Breath Away, and then Yemi Alade ends it with Vibe.
I will make you my dreams post if you want to. They love to you and you can scream out if you want to. Together, I fuck you together. One day, now you know better. It's the place I want to be now. If I want a lot of guilty rich, don't wanna leave now. Cause I never thought life be so hard, it never got easy. But I thank God for this blessing, yeah. Welcome to Africa.
Gimme cap, make a DJ, Mr. DJ. Sit down on the mic. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Me wanna sit down on the mic. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Say me wanna sit down on the mic. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Sit down on the mic. Sit down on the mic. Oh, it's a vibe. It's a vibe. It's a vibe. Is a vibe, is a vibe, yeah. Is a vibe, mm. I never say come over, I don't they run come. Top of the class, me know the bottom. Top up me glass with coca and rum. See me coming now, wanna holla. Baby, no time for the drama. Nah, I don't wanna be your baby mama. Wanna lie with my love, Miss Kata. Sit down on the mic. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Me wanna sit down on the mic. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Say me wanna sit down on the mic. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Sit down on the mic. Sit down on the mic. Oh, see me coming now. Wanna holla, baby, baby, no time for the drama. Nah, no. Baby mama, I sit down on the mic. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Me wanna sit down on the mic. Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Say me wanna sit down on the mic. Yo, oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Sit down on the mic. Sit down on the mic. Oh, it's a vibe. Oh, 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 oh,
and that was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpoga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Wojtek Zoniak, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, do not allow the belly to make you useless. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. The Supreme Court of